DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotta Lomas. On today's episode, we talk conflict and conservation. And we start by meeting someone with a wide lens on the world. Tim Lehman is a wildlife photojournalist and a photographer for National Geographic. He has the enviable job of travelling to the most remote parts of the world to snap pictures of endangered species. But there's one place in Southeast Asia that Tim keeps returning to, and that's the rainforests of Borneo Island. Tim's photographic documentation of Bornean orangutans has won him a bunch of awards, and this year he was named Wildlife Photographer of the Year for his image titled Entwined Lives. I spoke with Tim Lehman and asked him just how he managed to get this winning shot.
Yeah, this photograph shows a young male orangutan climbing up a tree trunk. He's climbing up some roots, some big strangler fig roots that are descending the tree. And he's climbing up toward the camera, and the camera is a really wide view, looking down into the rainforest and seeing this, you know, kind of down the tree trunk, seeing the orangutan coming up. And I set this camera up in this position. I could have never been up there in the tree and have the orangutan come that close. These are totally wild orangutans in a national park in Indonesian part of Borneo. But what I did was I set up a remote camera in a place where I thought the orangutan was going to come back to. And, you know, normally I'm down on the ground, looking up with a telephoto lens, trying to get pictures of orangutans and interesting things that they're doing. And I realized that, you know, one thing people haven't seen is what it's like sort of up in the canopy, you know, up there with the orangutans. And so I had this idea to make a photograph like this for a long time. And finally last year, the sort of right situation presented itself, where the fruiting tree that the orangutans came to, and I thought that this orangutan would probably come back again the next day because there was so much fruit left. And so after he left, I climbed the tree and rigged up some remote control cameras.
This is like very high up. From the image at least, it looks like you're incredibly high up in this tree. Like, how did that work? How did you get up there?
Yeah, it's about 30 meters off the ground where the orangutan is and where the camera is. And the way I climb these big trees that don't have any lower branches is I use a bow and arrow to shoot a fishing line. I tie a fishing line onto the arrow, and I fire it up and over a big branch in the tree. And then I use that to pull up a climbing rope, which I anchor off one end, and then I climb up the rope using a harness and ascenders, like sort of like mountaineering equipment. And so, yeah, I've been doing that for many years. It's a very useful way to access the canopy because, of course, I can't climb like an orangutan up to 30 meters in a tree.
What did you want to capture in this photograph?
In this image, I really wanted to capture the habitat. And so that's why I wanted to use a wide lens. And I wanted to convey the sort of importance of the forest for the orangutans because as they're, you know, as they become more endangered, the biggest limiting factor for them is remaining good forest. And the main reason they're becoming endangered, more and more endangered, is because of loss of forest. So my hope was that this picture that shows the, you know, expansive good rainforest still remaining in the background can show how important that is for the orangutans.
Conservation is central to your work. Why are you particularly interested in orangutans?
Well, you know, orangutans are one of our closest relatives, the only great ape that's found in Asia. And since humans sort of arrived on the scene, I think, you know, tens of thousands of years ago in that region, the orangutan numbers have been plummeting. They've been hunted. Their, you know, forest has been cleared. And so we have really squeezed these orangutans down into a relatively small areas. And I feel like it's, you know, it's our responsibility to give them space to survive into the future.
What does a career as a wildlife photographer look like? I mean, what does a day in the life of Tim Lehman's work entail?
Yeah, well, yes, being a wildlife photographer, definitely to get the unique shots that I want to capture, I definitely have to kind of push myself into maybe uncomfortable situations. It's good not to have too high of standards of personal comfort, because it's better if you don't mind having wet feet all day, you know, tromping through the swamps and things like that. So, yeah, following orangutans, you know, if the orangutan crosses a river in the trees above the river, and you want to stay with them, you kind of have to wade across the river down at the ground level. It means really a lot of long days in the forest. I'm usually up before dawn and I'm out often for, 12-hour day following orangutans all day through the forest and sleeping in a fairly, rustic situation where I'm taking a bath in the river and eating, rice and noodles for dinner. So there are times when it's, you're in like a spectacular place, you get to go to these beautiful places and be out in nature, but it's not quite as romantic as a lot of people think it may be, because you also spend a lot of time, schlepping a lot of equipment through airports and traveling on bad transportation in third world countries and things like that. And there are many, many days when you don't get any great shots. You may spend, hours and hours, days and days following orangutans and only get a really great opportunity to photograph something only a few minutes out of, every day. So, it requires a lot of perseverance.
And as you say, you spend a lot of time waiting around for the right shot, and I mean, really, really depends on the animals as well. How much of it comes down to luck of you encountering the animal and it doing what you want it to do at the right time?
Yes, well, I mean, I'm a firm believer in the... maybe it's a cliche, but that, you make your own luck. Like you're not going to get lucky and have a great view of the orangutan doing something really interesting unless you're out there with the orangutan, and following it and trying to get yourself into the right position. And so it's all about, putting the effort out to get out there into the field. So the only way you're definitely going to not get any pictures is to just, stay in bed.
And how close do you get to them?
I think probably the closest I've been to maybe a male orangutan who was traveling on the ground and had gotten used to me over several days was maybe about 8 or 10 meters away. So don't get, really close. Don't get extremely close. You have to respect the animal's comfort zone and keep your distance. If you push that and get too close, then you'll get threatened. And it's happened to me a couple times where I accidentally got a little too close and had a big, 100 kilo male orangutan kind of sort of lunge toward me in a threatening manner. And when that happens, you just have to look down, kind of look aside, sort of show him that, he's the boss, make yourself small, and, everything's fine, he moves on. But I don't like to cause those kind of interactions, so I try to keep my distance.
Maybe you just wanted a selfie. What do you hope to come out of this photograph? What do you hope for the viewers to take away from it?
Yeah, my hope is that viewers will have a increased appreciation of the need to protect rainforest, the intact remaining rainforest for orangutans. You hear so many, bad things about forest loss and oil palm replacing all the forest, but I think people lose sight of the fact that there are still good forests, there are still national parks protecting good habitat, and protecting these reserves where the orangutans remain for the future is something that I feel is really important, and I hope my pictures will help bring some attention to that.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere. Their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression, no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow, no tomorrow. No tomorrow.
But it's not just these forests that are facing an uncertain future. Over the last 25 years, humans have destroyed a tenth of Earth's remaining wilderness, according to a recent report published in the journal Current Biology. And if trends continue, this research suggests that within a century, there could be hardly any wilderness left at all. Here in Europe, one of the few remaining pockets of old-growth forests can be found in the Romanian Carpathians. These forests are rich in biodiversity, including Europe's largest surviving populations of brown bear, wolf and lynx, as well as an astonishing one-third of all European plant species. But the environmental organisation Greenpeace says these treasures are at risk thanks to illegal or ill-planned logging and environmental degradation. They have just held a forest rescue camp to document the forests and raise awareness of the natural wealth before it's too late. Christian Cummins has the story.
In a forest clearing close to the shores of Lake Vidraru in the Făgăraș Mountains, 4 hours northeast of Bucharest, there's a huddle of canvas tents and mossy cabins and a field kitchen doling out steaming cups of coffee and a vegan breakfast. One of the breakfasters is climber Alex Gavan, who has scaled some of the Himalaya's highest peaks, but has a special affection for this area.
I was born in these mountains, I grew up in these mountains, I was inspired by these mountains. But why these mountains are special is that here we still have one of the last patches of authentic wilderness in Europe.
The director of Greenpeace Romania, Marina Babalata, welcomes me to the camp she calls the Forest Rescue Station. But what do the forests need rescuing from?
Romania has still among the most valuable forests in Europe, given their conservation value and the amount of virgin beech forests and virgin forests in general that are still left here. However, alarmingly, we are losing it due to illegal logging, due to degradation as well. Our estimates are that we are losing 3 hectares an hour of forest that is being degraded every year.
Virgin forests, where there has been so far no human intervention, or quasi-virgin forests, where human intervention has been minimal, are marvellous examples of how nature cooperates to create a strong whole out of individual species, explains Magor Cibi of WWF Romania.
If you want to see how was Europe 30,000 years ago, you go to a virgin forest. It means that no standing trees are too vulnerable to wind. There are no trees vulnerable to insects. The vulnerability is not there because the diversity is so big, because the system is so perfect that it just has all the means to protect itself. So the virgin forest, if you leave now and we put something around them, you know, a big fence or something which isolates from the rest of the world, and we will come back 100,000 years later, we will see exactly the same system because it has always the right answers.
And yet this natural wealth is often poorly understood by the public and by the authorities who claim to protect the forests. That's why the camping team of 30 volunteers, half of them from Romania, but others from Germany, Austria, Slovenia, and Holland, are creating an inventory of the forest. One troop of volunteers is led off for a day's work in the woods by Gesche Jürgens, a forestry expert from Greenpeace Germany.
The Romanian government has recently decided that they want to protect all remaining primary or old-growth forests, and they want to register them. And they ask everyone, the public, NGOs, to submit areas where they identify a forest that still qualifies according to the official criteria. And that's why we're measuring all the trees with a certain diameter size. We're measuring all the deadwood with a certain diameter size. So we're basically following a very strict methodology in order to really propose that area to be added to this catalogue.
We hike across steep ground to a half-hectare area that the volunteers have marked out the day before in red and white tape. These are sample plots that have been chosen to represent a wider area of 140 hectares. It's been very tricky getting here.
Yeah, that is true. There's a good reason why these forests could survive, basically, for such a long time. And one of the main reasons is really that they're quite inaccessible.
Once we get to the plot, some very strange-looking instruments are assembled, including a tall scythe-like implement to measure diameter, which a volunteer called Freya shows us how to use.
We take the diameters and just put it around here. And we have now 41 centimeters. Mm-hmm.
This is long and painstakingly slow work. It will take a full month to complete the entire inventory project. But Andreea, a Romanian volunteer, says it will be worth it when their work is presented to the Romanian government.
At least we hope so. We have to hope so. But I think it's also important, okay, you can change things from the top down, like going to the government, but each of the volunteers have to go to their own communities where they come from and spread the word and raise, more than raise awareness, really shake people.
Most of the volunteers have taken the little time they have off from strenuous jobs to be here, but protecting the forests is an emotive subject in Romania. 30-year-old Lorenzo Radu says he's here for the sake of his children.
I'm the father of two sons, and I want my son to breathe the clear air and to have what we have. Because if we continue to destroy the nature, there will be only pollution and something like this.
Conservationists say some 80 million cubic meters of wood have been illegally chopped down over the past two decades. The government has taken steps to protect the forests, recently deciding to classify illegal logging as a threat to national security and increasing by fivefold the penalties for those caught chopping down trees without a valid permit. But Alex Gavan says the latest available figures show the problem is getting worse.
In 2009-2010, there were 30 cases of illegal logging per day recorded. After that, they went to 50 to 60 cases, and now we arrive to this psychological limit of 100 cases of illegal logging per day, you know?
This increase could also partially be due to better reporting of the problem, and civil society is certainly reacting. In May last year, 20,000 people marched on the streets of more than 10 cities across Romania to demand that forests be respected. And Magor Chibi of WWF Romania says if we don't respect nature, then the consequences will be grave.
We are already seeing that we do not have enough resources. We already see that we do not have enough means and ideas how to create the future for us. And the only way to understand or get a better model will be from nature. And if we want a better model from nature, we need to go back when nature is functioning.
It's a race against time for the activists. Trees can be replanted, but once the complicated, interconnected ecosystems of primary forests are destroyed, they're gone forever. Yet Alex Gavan says he and his fellow ecologists are up for the challenge of stopping businesses turning natural treasures into saleable commodities.
I really, really believe that the forest is not timber, wildlife is not game, and as we can see in this Greenpeace camp, we are not few.
Christian Cummins, Deutsche Welle, Romania.
Conserving forests to preserving tradition, we turn to the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic, where each year hundreds of pilot whales are rounded up and slaughtered by hand on the beaches. The meat is carved up amongst families and frozen ready to defrost and consume later. The grind, as the custom is called, dates back 1,000 years, and many islanders want it to carry on. But the tradition is facing new challenges, as Joel Carnegie reports from the Faroe Islands.
Here we are in Hvannasund, a small village about an hour and a half drive away from the capital, Tórshavn. Faroese local Peter Rasmussen is watching a grind hunt from the shoreline.
When the boats come in, there's a lot of banging on the boats because they try to make it so there's a moving wall behind them. So they push them into the shores. You can hear the screeches when they come to shore and when they get caught.
The aim is to kill the whales as soon as possible, because if the whales get too stressed, it apparently ruins the meat. Those tiny squeaks you can hear are the whales calling out. And in this hunt, 135 whales are killed. In recent years, the grind, as this custom is known, has come into the international spotlight, with its slaughtering methods being actively challenged by animal rights activists, including Sea Shepherd. Jens Morten Rasmussen is an active Faroese whaler, He says that pilot whale is still an important and sustainable food source for the islands.
Almost everything you see in the supermarket is imported. If you feel that you can eat a chicken and you're saying that I cannot kill a whale, you're a total hypocrite. For me, it is killing an animal is killing an animal, and you can't even do that as a good thing. It is a necessary thing today for getting food. Of course, if we go way back, this was the thing between life and death. And we can read in the history that there has been starvation, and then the whales came and the starvation was over.
But now, pilot whale meat and blubber is so heavily contaminated by mercury and other chemicals by ocean pollution that medical authorities on the islands are actively discouraging consumption. Since 1984, the chief physician of the Department of Occupational Medicine and Public Health in the Faroese hospital system, Dr. Paul Vaya, has been researching and testing the effects of eating pilot whale.
It's a fact that there's a lot of pollutants in the big oceans. And these contaminants end up in the high north, especially in population eating sea mammals like we do in the Faroes.
The research concluded that contaminants in pilot whale meat and blubber appeared to increase the risk of developing Parkinson's disease, hypertension, arteriosclerosis, even cognitive deficiencies in children.
The medical profession in the Faroes is recommending not to eat it at all. Of course, when you're talking about toxicology, there's a big difference between people. So the consequences of eating in an old age is not the same as in your young age. But the recommendation from the health authorities are still unchanged. Of course, there's a lot of people have an opinion on that, but they are not scientifically based at all.
But the Faroese government is reluctant to put a ban on whaling. Kate Sanderson is head of the mission of the Faroe Islands to the EU and has been a government advisor on whaling for over 25 years. She believes that as eating pilot whale is an individual choice and has been part of the fabric of Faroese culture for so long, it's not something that the Faroese government would want to ban.
I think we have to understand it is good food. It's not our fault that one has to be careful how much one eats. These pollutants are not coming from here. They're coming from industrial processes elsewhere around the world. So that's where the real focus should be, really. I mean, it's not whether other people don't like what we do in the Faroes and therefore we should stop. It's let's let the Faroe Islanders keep doing what they're doing and clean up the seas.
Rooney Nielsen is a Faroese environmentalist and food safety consultant. He says that whaling has become a political hot potato in the Faroe Islands.
They will defend it, but they will not make any change, even though it is what is recommended by the scientists.
Why is that?
I think it's politically a protection of your rights to provide yourself with food. And the health issue itself has been clouded by the national issue. So where you have a threat from the outside that is saying you are not allowed to do this and this, it's becoming really, really black and white. If you are a politician and you say we should not, maybe not kill so many pilot whales because it's really unhealthy for the consumers, and this politician that says this is then being accused of being a Sea Shepherd supporter. So it's this fine line is really hard to draw in politics. I think it's something that has come from the people.
And whilst this might take some time, the overarching consensus is that whale isn't such a large part of the Faroese national diet anymore, a fact that at least the whales can be thankful for. Joel Carnegie, DW, the Faroe Islands.
When you think of conservation in Rome, Italy, you probably first think of the spectacular ancient ruins scattered throughout the city, from the imposing Colosseum to the hidden catacombs. Many of the ruins and artefacts date back some 2,500 years, but an even older treasure trove from the past lies beneath and around the city. Elephant remains. Our reporter Megan Williams visited an elephant graveyard on the outskirts of Rome to get a look at some of these mammoth remains.
This is the bottom of the river, and then
scientist Federica Marano and I are standing in a sea of huge white bones, ribs, vertebrae, femurs, tibiae, spread out around us on a moon-like surface. Marana is a geologist with the Earth Science Department at the Sapienza University here in Rome. She's showing me around a place called the Poledrar di Ceca Nibbio. It's on the rolling countryside west of Rome and looks like a warehouse from the outside. Inside, though, it contains the biggest elephant graveyard in Europe. And not just any elephants, but giant 300,000-year-old ones, known as Palaeologzodon antiquus.
These elephants were very big, larger than the African elephants. The shoulder height is more than 3 meters and a half. The tusks are longer than 3 meters.
So it would be taller than the building we're standing in.
Yes.
This is just one of 140 elephant graveyards throughout Rome. One is near the Colosseum, which for years archaeologists mistook as the bones of beasts killed during the cruel games held there. The Poledrara is just one of two sites that have been properly excavated. Work here began in 1985, but due to shortage of money, it was only recently opened to the public. The elephants arrived here in Italy 800,000 years ago from Africa and thrived during the same period as Neanderthals. Little blades and axes scattered throughout show they ate them.
We know this because around the bones of this carcass, of this skeleton, we found a lot of implements, and some bones were intentionally fractured for the meat and also for the bone marrow.
Poignant signs of human life lie here, too.
We found that the small feet of baby.
Footprint?
Yes, a small tooth of a baby that we prove the presence of human beings here.
It's still debated whether prehistoric humans actually hunted the elephants or whether they simply ate them after they died. So we're standing looking at them now.
But in this case, there are no evidence of human. Probably they died trapped in the mud.
Head paleontologist here, Maria Rita Palombo, points at what look like fossilized tree stumps. They're the upright tibiae, or shin bones, still stuck to the very spot the elephants died.
Some elephants were trapped because elephants like to go into the mud, like in Africa today, during the summer, during the starvation period, to eat salts inside the ponds.
However they perished, it's a powerful experience to gaze upon the remains of these ancient giants all around you.
We would like that the people come in this site and know about the prehistory of Rome.
As an important reminder, says Federica Marana, that history in Rome dates back much further than ancient times. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
And that ends this week's show. For more from Living Planet, download our podcast on iTunes, check us out on SoundCloud, or just visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.